Welcome to the GAC Files, a podcast about the people, issues, and ideas driving Global Affairs Canada.
Bienvenue dans les dossiers d'AMC, un balado sur les personnes, les défis et les idées qui animent Affaires mondiales Canada.
And now, introducing your host, Global Affairs Canada's David Morrison.
Et maintenant, présentant votre hôte, David Morrison d'Affaires mondiales Canada.
Marcy Grossman began her public service career with a keen interest in young offenders and a desire to work in corrections. She spent nearly a decade doing so before migrating to the international world, first with Industry Canada and then with Foreign Affairs. She has spent most of her time abroad in the United States as Consul General in Miami and Denver and Deputy Consul General in Los Angeles. Marcy and I recently chatted about her journey in life, her chutzpah, and how when she wants something, she simply visualizes it. Hey, Marcy, thanks for stopping by.
Hey, David, thanks for having me. I'm surprised I got selected, actually. But
I was thinking in preparing for this morning when we first met, and my recollection is that in the fall of 2013, I was just about to become ADM Americas, yep. And there was a meeting of all of the consuls general from across the U.S. mission network, yes, here in Ottawa. And you came up to me with a beer, having bought it for me.
Yeah, out of my for reals money.
You said, I want you, now I know you'll remember me because I'm the person that bought you your first beer as an ADM. And so for all GAC Files listeners, it's a strategy that works.
Because
I do remember it. In any event, that was when I discovered, Marcy, that you were a stalwart of our mission network in the United States. Having served in Dallas and Miami and Los Angeles and Denver when we met. Since then, you have done a lot of work to get the Invest in Canada Departmental Cooperation up and running, and you're now just about to go back out as a HOM to a different part of the world. So lots to talk about, but let's start where it all started back in Montreal. Tell me about growing up.
Wow, thanks. Well, first of all, yes, I was born in Montreal, but actually in the suburbs. Comme on dit à Montréal, dans le West Island.
Ouais.
Alors, un petit coin dans le west de l'île. I grew up in
petit coin anglophone.
Oui.
Ouais.
Tellement anglophone. Et that has actually been the bane of my existence.
Yeah.
Particularly since my father was French, from France, and never spoke French to me. And I lived in Montreal, and I basically struggled to speak French.
When did he come to Canada?
He came to Canada just after the war. He was actually a survivor of the Holocaust and managed to get immigration to Canada with his family. And actually at the age of 17, he arrived. Actually, he spoke German and French, and he now speaks English without an accent. So he was a great linguist. Unfortunately, he never spoke to me. Alors, c'est la raison pour laquelle on parle souvent en anglais. aujourd'hui, mais je me prête pour aller pour faire une petite formation pour que je puisse parler mieux en français.
Ouais. Siblings?
I have a sister. She's a little younger than I am. She lives in Toronto. She has two young kids. And we had a very nice existence growing up in the West Island. It was sort of like country at the time. There was not a lot of connection actually to the downtown core. We didn't get buses until I was practically already driving. So we were a little dislocated, so being in the big city was a big thing, but it was a very sort of nice pastoral existence in the West Island.
And what brought you to Ottawa?
Well, actually, I started my, as every good Montreal Jewish girl, I went to McGill. There wasn't even a question.
Right.
It wasn't even a conversation in my house. I never even asked out loud, I wonder where I should go to university, because everyone goes to McGill. Why would you not go? Why would you go anywhere else if you're from Montreal? And I went the first year, and I did not realize that you're supposed to actually move out of your house to have a good time. So there I was commuting from the West Island. And
your mother was very happy.
Pardon me?
Your mother was very
happy.
My
mother was happy, and her pocketbook was happy, but I was miserable.
Right.
And I had actually gotten early admission to Carleton when I was 17, because in Montreal you go to 11th grade. But before you even go to Cégep, you can get an early admission to Carleton. You do a pre-qualifying year, and you can go at age 17. So I thought about the summer and how over the summer, and I wasn't happy with my performance, and I just wasn't happy. And I called up Carleton literally Labor Day weekend before school started second year, and I was like, hey, remember me? I applied. I got in Q year. I've done a year at McGill. Could I come to Carleton? And they're like, yeah, sure. Come on down. Back in the day, that's basically what you had to do. And I came to Ottawa, and I loved it. This really was an opportunity for me to really blossom as a person, and it was perfect because I wanted to be in public service always. I knew starting from probably age 16 that I wanted to be a psychologist, I wanted to help people, and I actually knew quite early on I wanted to be a criminal psychologist. So my big dream was actually to work in the federal system, you know, in the big house, in corrections.
Why did you want to be a criminal psychologist? I mean, some would say that's a great preparation
for
Global
Service.
Affairs Canada.
Yeah. it really just a thought that came to me. I want to say it's a bit of a cliche. It actually came to me in a dream where I actually pictured myself sitting across the desk from young offenders. They weren't actually adult prisoners; they were youth, and I felt like all the stuff that happens to disadvantaged kids that get them into trouble in their early years, what can be done to sort of break that cycle and help them out. And I was really committed to that, and I actually ended up with a master's degree in criminal psychology
from Carleton. So you graduated and you joined Corrections Canada.
The dream. A lot of people ask me if, you know, I tell them I went to Carleton, they think I went to the Norman Patterson School. I said, no, I didn't take public. I didn't take political
science. So you worked in prisons, in jails?
I did. I did my master's thesis. It was a applied clinical research project. I developed a treatment program for young offenders at the Ottawa Carleton Detention Center. I implemented, I assessed it, and with that and those credentials, I translated that into a co-op. Not a co-op, actually, an FSWEP.
FSWEP.
Whatever it was called. Federal Service.
Federal Student Employment.
Yes.
Something,
whatever it was called at the time. I was just graduating I was just finishing my master's thesis, and I got a job at Federal Corrections for the summer. And I was like, I am not leaving this place. I love it here. This is what my calling is.
And you spent the decade.
Almost a decade. Actually, it was about a decade, yeah.
And then what? How did you convert from corrections officer to...
Yeah.
And that's a job, Federal Corrections, that could have sent you anywhere in Canada, presumably.
Right. So, first of all, after I had my experience in jail, and then I got to the Ivory Tower, I realized I was not a jail person. Like, my career goal was not to be a warden and run a prison. I liked the Ivory Tower. I liked making things. I liked decreeing policy, creating programs for other people to implement, but I didn't want to go back to the jail. I found it very disheartening. And I got promoted a few times in those early years that took me further and further from the content of what I was doing, and so it was a lot more administrative. And then that started opening up opportunities for me, though, and possibilities. And I actually got noticed by an ADM at the time. I was a sort of a junior officer, and I was nominated for the Career Assignment Program, which at the time was the federal government's longest-standing program, and it was basically a training program that took middle managers to the executive level through a series of learning sessions and different stages that you would do a year in a different federal department to get different types of experiences. And
so where did you work?
I went to the Treasury Board because, of course, getting a central agency was a big tick mark. I did one position in-house in corrections as the Director of Federal Provincial Relations, so I got a sense of what that experience was like. I went to the Canada School of Public Service, which at the time was called Canadian Centre for Management Development. But I always knew I wanted to do something international. But I always thought it would be correctional. So I always thought So I wanted to try to translate, and I had to make, and the other thing was that this forced me to have a 5-year plan, because they wouldn't let you go forward unless you had this plan of where you wanted to do your assignments and how you wanted to learn. So I tried for my 5th assignment to try to translate into an international assignment where I could go to, say, Bosnia or one of the new stands to help them create a judicial system and a correctional system. That was like my big passion, and that was really the only content I knew. But I didn't know how to make that happen. So I was a bit discouraged, and I got a referral to a woman who was a DG at an organization called Investment Partnerships Canada, which was basically the precursor to what is now the new Invest in Canada departmental corporation. She was very lovely, and she sounded very friendly, and I was just looking for a warm place to work, because I was a little discouraged about not getting to the dream. And it was great. She was, which is what I tell a lot of people is, you don't always have to go where the best work is. Sometimes it's better to go where the best boss is. That never fails you. Even if it's just a transit point for you, that never fails you. And she seemed awesome, and she was awesome. And before I knew it, I was in an organization that was co-managed by Industry Canada and the Department of Foreign Affairs. And I would see these broadcast messages come up with these job opportunities, and finally, after a few months, I would be like, am I allowed to apply for those? And they're like, yeah, sure. Yeah, if you're here, you can apply.
And these were temporary job opportunities, or?
No. Well, they could have been TDs, but because this organization was co-managed by the both departments, the employees of this special agent, it wasn't a SOA, it was just a unique little unit, were able to apply for postings, even if I wasn't rotational.
So what, you were a CO?
I was an EX-1.
EX-1.
I was doing that last stage, and then I was going to take my executive exams, and then I would become an executive, hopefully, if I passed the exams.
Yeah, this is a thing that I just learned from Marcy before we went on the air, that the culmination of this CAP program was, you said, a 2-day process of examinations and
psychological,
what, interviews?
Oh my gosh. You went to what was called the Psychological Assessment Center. The day before you went, they gave you a package of material, and it gave you a character. I don't say if they still use it, but I was director of a Parks Canada site.
And you had to do a role play.
And I had to role play for 2 days. So I would role play, I knew who I was when I arrived, and then I had to do a huge inbox and clear it, inbox exercise. And then actors would start showing up into my room where I was, and there'd be someone in the corner taking notes, rating my behavior. So I had Greenpeace come and show up, and then I'd have to go to a staff meeting, and my goal was, they say you have to get through this agenda in your staff meeting, and then I'd have, actors, lunging over the table trying to kill each other, and I'd be like, oh, wait,
So anyhow, I think that program doesn't exist.
Unfortunately, not
anymore.
It was amazing.
But it was obviously driven by trying to create a cadre of people across the government who had a shared experience and had been identified as high flyers and who had tested into the EX-1.
Yeah, it was very careful.
Band. Yeah, very careful
selection.
Nurturing of talent.
Yeah.
And you ended up somehow in Dallas.
Yes. So once my husband had a sister in Dallas, and he always wanted to live in Dallas. And when you work in corrections, you can't ever live in Dallas because Dallas is like the antithesis of what Canada was doing. And I loved the Canadian corrections at the time. Like, rehabilitation was first and foremost, and getting people back into the communities and reducing the rate of return, that was a huge priority. They don't do that in Dallas. I said, we're never going to Dallas. Like, I could not ask the Deputy Minister of Corrections, the Commissioner, to go on an assignment to Dallas. It would never be allowed.
The American philosophy was just different.
Especially there, when they were privatizing and everything. He had always wanted to go to Dallas. And this unit that I was working on actually had a pilot project going on in Dallas. And I was like, well, maybe if I align myself with this project, something could happen. So I was part of this pilot project. We were testing. It was a branding. We were interviewing CEOs in the market to see what they thought about Canada, if they would invest in Canada, that kind of stuff. And I found that fascinating, the work, and I've started to develop a new content. And a TD opportunity presented itself. Prime Minister Chrétien was leading the last Team Canada West and last Team Canada mission of its day to Dallas and Los Angeles, and the investment officer position was vacant. The woman had left suddenly mid-posting. This was, or early in her posting. This was November. They had no one in the seat, and someone needed to produce an investment roundtable. So they needed someone to go to Dallas for 2 weeks to do this. I'm just like, well, you know, take me.
So just to open up, just to explain a little bit for our younger listeners, just give it in 30 seconds, what was Team Canada?
What was
that approach about?
Yeah, so this was a Team Canada West, so it only involved the Western premiers and probably the territories. But in a full Team Canada, the Prime Minister would go with each of the premiers of each of the countries and a business
each of the provinces.
Sorry. Excuse me. I've been living in the States too long. I don't know my provinces from territories and countries. Each of the provinces, so the premiers of each province and business delegations, and they would all swoop in to a place, usually Europe, China, wherever. And the goal was to promote Canada, promote the Canada brand, sign political, you know, MOUs or deals
massive trade promotion and investment attraction.
Yeah, try to sign deals.
Undertakings.
Yeah, and the premiers would promote their individual provinces. And, of course, at the time, Gary Duber was the premier of Manitoba, and he was promoting Crown Royal, as he still did as ambassador, right, to the United States, Canadian ambassador. But this was a huge thing, and, all singing, all dancing, and there was no one to do one important task.
Right.
So I said, well, I'll go. I was flexible. I went, and cold calling Michael Dell's office, whoever. I had no idea what I was doing, but in the end...
For listeners who haven't figured it out yet, Marcy has no fear. She just jumps in with both feet to everything. So you rose to this challenge.
I did. At the end of the 2 weeks, it was a very successful investment roundtable. And at the end of the 2 weeks, I went to the head of mission and I said, I know your investment officer left. You're not going to get anyone until the summer rotation. It's December 1 now. The mission has ended. I said, I would love to come back and fill that position for you. I could come immediately. My kids are mobile. My husband's mobile. And, of course, I got this, you're not really from here. You're really, you're new. I said, well, be honest, with all due respect, sir, I'm better than no one. I've proven that to you. I can do something. Yeah. And sure enough, by February 16th, so this is December 1, by February 16th, I was reporting for duty in Dallas, Texas, as the investment officer. Two kids in tow, registered at school, house sold. Boom.
Chutzpah
for sure.
There's a theme that's going to continue in this chat. But anyhow, you parlayed that into quite a remarkable run within the U.S. network. Mm-hmm. So from that investment job in Dallas to a fully paid-up HOM, Consul General in Miami with cross accreditation to Puerto Rico and
maybe, U.S. Virgin Islands,
a couple other places.
It's a hardship
post. Yeah. then you went to L.A. And listeners should know that these postings to the U.S. are normally 4 years and sometimes 5 years. Anyhow, when Marcy bought me that famous beer in downtown Ottawa, the only other thing I knew about her was that she hadn't been back in Ottawa for over a decade, which made me appreciate her chutzpah even more.
Yeah.
Tell us, Marcy, about that run and why, when you join the Foreign Service or when people think of this department, they don't necessarily think of being posted to the U.S.
Right.
We have consulates in Minneapolis and Detroit, in obviously Denver and other places. But what's it like being a Foreign Service officer in the United States?
Right. Well, it's actually amazing. Well, first of all, Well, it's amazing for a few reasons. One of the reasons it's amazing is that nobody's looking at the U.S.
Right.
It's not people. Most people, like, I'm not from the Foreign Service, right? I'm from jail. Anything looks better than jail. But when most people join the Foreign Service, they want to have a really foreign experience. They want to go to the Beijings and the Parises and the Londons, and they want to do hardship posting, and the CETA folks want to get, you know, as down and dirty as they can, and the former CETA folks, excuse me, and the policy wonks want to go to Geneva, and et cetera, et cetera. Nobody's looking at the U.S., so it was perfect for me. I was like,
you're a diplomat in a town without diplomats.
Yeah, well, all the more reason why you can own a town.
Yeah.
Because you are like an oddity. In some, I would say in Los Angeles and Miami, they had a huge consular corps. Mm. People knew what diplomats were. They knew what your job was. They knew you had funny license plates. I have to say in Denver, there was not a huge consular corps. And even in Dallas, it was a bit of an oddity. But what people don't realize about the U.S. is it's not one market.
Yeah.
It is 50 markets. Every state is a different... I mean, if California was a country, I think now it would be the 7th largest country economy in the world.
Right.
Texas, the amount of GDP in Texas is probably greater than Canada. I know California has surpassed Canada. And the philosophies and the cultures of each of these regions is so different. And even in a territory of Texas, where I had Arkansas, Oklahoma, New Mexico, very, very different everything. So they're all really unique. I mean, you're closer, Toronto is closer to New York than Dallas is, you know? So they're really countries and territories unto themselves, and so, so interesting. And of course, like, if you've served in the U.S., you've been saying the same thing for, you know, 20 years. The U.S. is the primordial market. And there's no more obvious that is the truth than today.
Yeah.
This very day.
When I was ADM Americas, I had to live this on a daily basis.
Right.
First by making the case somewhat gently that, you know, we sell about 3/4 of everything we manufacture to the United States, so our presence there is very important. And then, of course, in the period since November 2016 and the election of President Trump, that's become, you don't have to make that argument anymore. But
it's not just trade,
but what the role of Canadian diplomats in the U.S. is has had to change. Right,
I think I exited stage left at just the right time. Because I would be working my butt off now more than ever.
Yeah.
It's so
well,
important.
But also you wouldn't be the core of your job when you were in Denver.
Right.
Was trade promotion.
Right. Sell stuff.
And sell stuff and attract investment into Canada. And there was a you needed. Contacts. You needed to know the governor. You needed to. NORAD is there. That's an important institution. The governor general
visited when you were still there.
So there is a veneer of traditional diplomatic work, but our presence there was really about the economic ties between Canada and the United States. That is, of course, still the case, but we have. The network there and the personnel there have attracted a huge amount of new interest and attention doing advocacy.
Absolutely.
First, in the first 6 months of the Trump administration, just kind of reminding Americans at the non-Washington level, at the state level, at the municipal level, that Canada is often that state or that territory's greatest trading partner, the relationship is in great shape, and so on. Now, in the midst of a critical phase of a NAFTA negotiation, that presence is even more making itself felt, I would say. So you may have exited stage left at a time where you, as you said, you would have had to work very hard.
I would have been working twice as hard, for sure.
Yeah.
Because I see what my colleagues are doing right now, and it's amazing. Translating that sort of traditional relationship into a very different attitude and a very different approach. And you know what Tip O'Neill, his famous quote, all politics is local.
Yeah.
And so that's where the important work has to get done with your governors, with your congressional delegation, with your senators in market. Those are the people that vote on the issues that are important to Canada.
Right.
And you have to, that's your number one job, is getting them on board. And that's no more important than right now.
And those folks are often much more accessible
Absolutely.
In their districts than they are in Washington.
Oh, the governor of Colorado, John Hickenlooper, I could call him up and go to his office any time I wanted to. I would see him on the street. I would go to events and see him all the time. We were very friendly.
He's going to be in Canada shortly, and for listeners that don't know, he's talked about frequently as a presidential Democratic
Absolutely.
Presidential candidate.
Absolutely.
So we know.
Yeah. So these are the next presidents.
Right, and you know, I would say that from a departmental point of view, we no longer have to explain why our presence across the United States is useful, because
right.
I think that has been shown in spades since November 2016. Let's get back to your journey.
Mm-hmm.
You came back from the United States because basically we made you.
You made me, David.
Marcy was great at performance discussion time, which she and I would talk on the phone a couple times a year. How are things going? What are your objectives? What have you done for me lately? and this is, I hope, a message that's broadly applicable to listeners. I always appreciated that Marcy was exceptionally clear with me as her supervisor as to what she wanted in terms of a next step in her career, in terms of a next assignment, and in terms of an ultimate goal, because she didn't always get what she wanted, but at least I would be able to say, when Marcy's name came up when we were talking about assignments, oh, Marcy's been in the States a long time, here's how she sees her career evolving, and here's her ultimate goal. That was a very useful thing for me to know as a supervisor. So I encourage anyone that's having performance discussions with their supervisor to have thought in advance about what you want. Talk to me a little bit about, I mean, chutzpah is something that's already come up.
Right.
Marcy has it in spades, but talk to me about how that has worked
right.
for you.
So it's kind of a twofold process. First of all, being on the CAP program actually forced me to make a 5-year plan. I think everyone should have a 5-year plan, because if you don't have a 5-year plan, then you don't know where you're going.
Right.
A lot of people say, well, I just go with the flow, things come up, whatever. That is probably a fabulous way to run the universe. It's just not my way. And that's what really helped me. So I actually, at year one, had to say where I was going to be for the next 5 years, because I changed my job every year. I knew I wanted to end up internationally. And the other part of the equation is, well, then you have to communicate that to superiors, to the universe, and then you actually have to put some action to it. So I know that if I want to do an assignment, something international, in my fifth assignment for the career for the CAP program, that I have to align myself with people who are doing things internationally. I have to learn something about international. I have to. So am I? And if something else comes up, someone offers me another opportunity, I say no to it, because I know what my goal is. But the other interesting thing that happens for me is I actually start to really just visualize it and feel it and what it feels like. And so when I got to Dallas, I was still an EX minus one. I was basically, my position sat at Industry Canada, but I knew I didn't want to leave foreign affairs. Mm. And I started imagining how I could translate that into a career at Foreign Affairs, because I was on a secondment when I went to Dallas for that posting. And I graduated from the EX, cadre, like after I got to Dallas, and then I started, and I was having a great time being the investment officer. I started looking at my boss's job, senior trade commissioner, and I was like, that looks good.
Yeah,
like
I could do that.
See myself doing that. And sure enough, I think I could do it better than him too. And sure enough,
that sentiment is rife in
exactly.
this department.
Everyone thinks that. And I started just picturing myself what I would do if I was the senior trade commissioner. Sure enough, no word of a lie, the senior trade commissioner disappears one middle of the night, mid posting, never to be seen again. And I'm 1 year into my investment gig, and I go back to the HOM at admission. I said, I really love it here. I think you can see I'm doing some good work. I really, I'm looking at that senior trade commissioner job. I think I could do it. He's like, well, you're just here on secondment. You're still in EX minus one. That's an EX one position. I said, it's February. Like, you're not going to get anyone till summer assignment. I said, I'm better than no one.
Yeah.
And he thought about it for a couple of days, and he came back to me and said, okay, you can have it. Well, at the very same time, I finished
you got your EX1.
Executive. Yeah. Now I'm a EX1 at Industry Canada, and I'm thinking, and I'm senior trade commissioner, and I'm just like, momentum is building, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm in year two. I'm still a foreigner. Like, I'm still from Industry Canada. One morning I wake up in 2003 and I find out that all the resources from Investment Partnerships Canada along with other Industry Canada employees are transferred
to Foreign Affairs.
To Foreign Affairs.
Right.
Now I'm a rotational EX1 in the Department of Foreign Affairs and International Trade. I was on freaking cloud nine. And then after a year, I started momentum, successes, positive reinforcement, vision. I was like, I want to put my hat in the ring for something bigger. My boss offered me an extension because I got there in a half year. He said, you want to stay an extra year because you'll be leaving here at 3.5 years instead of four and a half. And I said, I really appreciate your offer. I said, but I'm going to put my hat in for a HOM job.
For Miami.
For head of mission. Miami.
Which was a EX2, probably.
It was an EX2, yeah. And he said, dear, God bless him. He was a lovely man. He gave me a lot of great advice. He says, it's not going to happen for you. Mm-hmm. You just got here. You got promoted in cycle. You just became an EX1. You just became rotational foreign service. Like, that's just not the way it rolls here. I said, whatever. I'm just putting it out to the universe. Again, in the HOM with those jobs, you got to put 5 jobs that you can picture yourself doing. And I thought, I want to go to Miami. That's where my people are. That's where my Canadian expat people are. That's where the largest Jewish diaspora is. And the Canadian Jewish diaspora. Those are my people. I could picture myself there. And sure enough, the universe responded. And I was probably the last one to find out that I got
that
the HOM
got
gig.
So we're just for reasons of time, we'll have to skip over L.A. and Denver we've already talked about. I do want to ask a little bit about what you tried to accomplish for the LES in the United States. When we met, you were the formal or informal champion of LES issues for the whole network, which is 13 or 14 missions.
Right.
The LES in the United States are 10% of the LES around the world, and they tend to be very senior. They
Absolutely.
Post a series of cutbacks. There are a lot of LE9s, which are super senior trade commissioners, sectoral specialists. Just talk to us a little bit about that and the stepping into that arena, but also for you, a real leadership.
Oh, yeah, it turned into that. It started off like a crazy idea. So I think it was that meeting where I met you. I actually wasn't actually confirmed for Denver yet. I think I was still sitting in L.A., and because I was the deputy there, I just was allowed to go to that meeting. And we had a briefing at that meeting in the big boardroom downstairs, and HR started talking about all the stuff that was going to be rolling out for the LES that Treasury Board had transferred the authorities back to the over to the department, that we were going to be looking at pensions and benefits, and there was going to be a big salary review that year. And having worked in the United States side by side with locally engaged staff for, you know, at that point probably 12 years, I knew how important that workforce was. As you said, this is like the core.
That's the heart and soul.
The heart and soul.
Some are, especially some are in the Canadians.
Many
are Americans.
Some of them are not Canadians, but they play a damn good Canadian on TV. Like, because they are so passionate about what they do, they are so committed to what they do. They don't. There's no differentiation. In other countries, I think there's these formal, informal, or reasons why you have to make these separations between locally engaged staff and Canada-based staff. But I never made those. If I saw a job that could be done just as well by a local staff than a Canada staff, I would just do it. In fact, my FPDS manager in Denver is a locally engaged staff. She is probably the best FPDS manager in the network. But she was like a pariah the first year. They didn't even want her to have her come to the meeting.
She was American.
So I also felt very passionate about, I could see what was coming down the line. And I thought, there's an opportunity here to make a big change in the workforce, in the whole shift in the workforce. Instead of death by a thousand cuts, which I could see could happen, we have an opportunity to shift the workforce into something a lot more important. We had an opportunity to modernize this workforce and start to work on, if we were going to start taking money away from people or benefits or levels or whatever, we should be offering them flexible workforce. We should be offering them more interesting jobs. We should be offering them opportunities to grow horizontally a lot more, to learn more. These are all things that were totally in our control.
Well, that's why I raise it, because you saw a problem that needed fixing. Nobody asked you to do it. You just knew it was important and stepped up, and others followed or joined you. And
or
I
didn't.
Just thought it was, or didn't. But it was a remarkable example, to my mind, of informal leadership. You weren't the boss of the people you were trying to get to follow you, but you deployed remarkable influencing skills. I remember one evening in Washington when you deployed a lot of wine.
Oh, goodness. I had to gin the group up to get approval, but
you did push the ball down the field, and I think you should
Thank
be
you.
Proud of,
Thank you.
Of what you were able to accomplish on behalf of those valued colleagues, many of whom have seen Canada-based staff come and go frequently, but they provide the continuity and the ballast and the ongoing representation for Canada throughout the United States, and as you've said, that's never been more important than it is now. I think we're out of time. I'm going to wish you all the best.
Thank you.
By the time this podcast comes out, where you're going will likely be public. Couldn't be more thrilled for you and for your family, and we'll look forward to hearing about the great things you're accomplishing in your new chapter.
Thanks, David. It's been a real honor to be able to share some of my stories with you today. And, you know, I just want to wrap by saying I always knew that I wanted to be in public service, because I always knew I had a call to service, and that's why I started in corrections, and that's why I've maintained my public service career. And I just want to say how proud I have been in this department and to serve Canadians' interests abroad. And I will continue to do that. And I appreciate the opportunities that you've given me.
Okay. Well, you've made many of those opportunities yourself, as we have found out on this podcast. Alors, merci beaucoup.
Merci,
et bonne chance.
Merci.
We hope you enjoyed today's discussion. If you have feedback or suggestions for future topics or guest speakers, please send David an email.
Nous espérons que vous avez apprécié la discussion d'aujourd'hui. Si vous avez des commentaires ou des suggestions concernant de sujets futurs ou de nouveaux conférenciers, veuillez envoyer un courriel à David.
Thank you for listening, and we look forward to you joining us on the next episode of The GAC Files.
Merci d'avoir écouté le balado, et nous espérons que vous vous joindrez à nous pour le prochain épisode des dossiers d'AMC.